Welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Hello, dear audience. Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Micro. As always, I hope you had a great week. And you can always find Let's Talk Micro on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Goodpods, wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find Let's Talk Micro. As far as social media, I am on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube as Let's Talk Micro, on X as Let's Talk Micro 1, on LinkedIn as Luis Plaza, and I have an email address which is letstalkmicro@outlook.com. So either via social media or via email, you can reach out with any topic suggestions. Any feedback, they are always welcome and appreciate it. And I please ask you to go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, download episodes, and if the app allows you to do so, please go ahead and leave a review. As always, I am so grateful for your support, so thank you. And as you know, learning about antibiotics can be quite difficult, so if you're looking to learn more about antibiotics, please check out www.learnantibiotics.com and the Learn Antibiotics book, available on Amazon. These resources include cheat sheets, practice test games, and more, and they are being used by thousands of people worldwide and may be helpful for you or your colleagues. So I definitely invite you to check out these resources from Dr. Timothy Gauthier, a very passionate pharmacist. And of course, speaking of antibiotics, as you know, season 4 premiered last week with a great episode about lolomycin. And as you know, antimicrobial resistance, you know, has many challenges, and one of them is developing new antimicrobials. And in this case, Dr. Paul Hergenbrother from the University of Illinois, he came to the podcast to talk about lolomycin, which is a potential antibiotic candidate. And in the episode, he talks about the LOL system. He talks about the mechanism of action of lolomycin, what organisms does it have activity against. And of course, one of the questions that we always get when we hear about antibiotics and when people take antibiotics is the depletion of the gut flora, right? Of the gut microbiota. So that's one of the questions. And he talks about that in the podcast, about how lolomycin does and does it affect the gut microbiota. So I think it was a great episode, very informative. And of course, Dr. Hergenrother, he's always, you know, his lab, they're always doing a lot of testing on potential compounds that can be antibiotics. So this is a great episode. I invite you to check it out. And definitely, if you haven't checked out the favimizing episode, I invite you to check out that one as well. Well, today we are talking about bone and joint infections. And maybe in the lab, if you work in microbiology, you're used to working with them, with cultures of this type of source. You know, for example, when it comes to like joint fluids, like synovial fluid, you hold them longer. And it's always interesting learning about this type of infections and learning about the organisms and seeing what happens beyond the lab. And in this episode, I am joined by Dr. John Gomez Jr., and he is an infectious diseases physician at Hospital del Mar in Barcelona, Spain. And he joins the podcast to talk about bone and joint infections. So he starts with an overview and he talks about why are they difficult to treat. He provides some examples of organisms that are seen in this type of infection. Of course, you know, we keep in mind that it varies with the type of infections and source, but he gives some examples of gram-positive organisms and of gram-negative organisms. He also talks about treatment, for example, choosing a good antibiotic that has antibiofilm effect. And he also talks about something called phases of treatment. So this is definitely a very informative episode, and I had a great time talking to Dr. Gomez. I definitely learned a lot. And this episode has a lot of good information, and as microbiologists, we know some of these things, and we know them working in the lab, and we know about organisms and things like that. But it's definitely great, as I said before, learning about what happens beyond the lab, what's happening with the patient. So all in all, a great episode, so let's go ahead and listen to it. As medical laboratory scientists, you know, when we're working on the bench, we work with different types of cultures, and some of them are from joint and bone, you know, the sources. And as you know, especially when it comes to joints, we typically keep them longer, you know, we treat them a little bit different than others. So I thought it would be good to talk about, you know, what happens outside the lab. So talk a little bit about bone and joint infections, you know, treatment and things like that. So with me today, I have a guest, and his name is Dr. John Gomez Jr. Dr. Gomez, welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Hello, thank you very much for the invitation.
My pleasure. So let's start with a quick introduction. Maybe if you can tell the audience what you do and anything else that you want to share.
Okay, so as you said, my name is Joan. I'm a medical doctor. I work in a hospital in Barcelona, Spain, called Hospital del Mar, and I am part of the infectious diseases team. This team is focused on patients admitted to the hospital with community-acquired infections, but also with hospital-acquired infections. And my field of expertise is especially bone and joint infections as part of other nosocomial infections, but especially those affecting bone and joints.
Well, definitely welcome for the audience. I was listening to a talk that Dr. Gomez gave in what's Egmont, or now it's ESC Med, and it was actually in Barcelona. So for you, it was closer this year, so you didn't have to travel, right? So that's always nice when you have a conference right at home.
Yeah, I could stay at home, but I have to say that it's also nice to have the opportunity to travel abroad and visit other cities and colleagues in their hometown. But yeah, it was definitely a good option to stay at home and have the family close by.
Yeah, definitely. So let's start with some basics. Maybe if you can give the audience some examples of bone and joint infections.
So, bone and joint infections include a wide variety of infections, and with or without the participation of implants and devices. So, there are infections of joints, such as septic arthritis or prosthetic or pre-prosthetic joint infections. There are also infections of the spine, such as vertebral osteomyelitis or spondylolisthitis, we often call it. And of course, there are also infections after spine instrumentation. And finally, we could include chronic osteomyelitis and fracture-related infections. And there is also a subgroup, which is a very particular scenario, which are diabetic foot infections, which are a very complex group of infections, often affecting joints or bones. So osteomyelitis and septic arthritis can coexist within these diabetic foot infections. Sometimes the bones and joints are not affected, and we are talking only about an infections of the skin and the soft tissues. And there are other phenomena going on, such as the presence of vasculopathy and neuropathy in these patients, which make them very complex and difficult to treat.
Yeah, when you were talking about diabetic foot infections, as a microbiologist, and I'm sure the audience, those of you that work with cultures, can identify those. Definitely, those cultures can have a lot of organisms. Sometimes, they can be very polymicrobial, those infections, and you find yourself, and it's very common, you're looking at one of these cultures, and you can have something from 2 to 3 Enterobacteriales, and E. coli, CLEB, and then you add to that maybe 2 or 3 non-fermenters as well. And some gram positive, so they can be very challenging, especially when you're learning in the profession to learn read cultures. So I just wanted to put that out there. So when I was listening to you talk, you said that sometimes this infections there can be complicated to treat. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so I think when we talk about bone and joint infections, we are facing generally a difficult scenario because of the patient, but also because of the infection itself. So generally, so infections of bone and joints are complex. They're usually associated, as I said, with implants, and this is generally a very difficult issue on in regarding the treatment. And sometimes or mostly these infections are associated with the presence of bacterial or organism biofilms. These biofilms, as you know, are very complex structures in which bacterial cells organize themselves. These are very complex structures. And in these structures or communities, bacteria are organized in different layers according to the different concentrations of nutrients and oxygen. And because of these issues, bacteria undergo several changes in their metabolism and growth rate. And this usually makes them more resistant to commonly given antibiotics. This is what we usually call tolerance. So this contributes definitely to the complexity of these infections. But there are other phenomena going on, such as the presence of intracellular bacteria which are often difficult to target with commonly given antibiotics, and also because of the impairment of the immune system, the poor penetration of antimicrobials, and also presence of particular bacterial cells, such as small colony variants or persisters. So because of these biofilms and all these features, these bone engine infections usually associated with biofilms, we need a complex or a difficult approach, complex approach to manage them, which usually consists of surgery and antibiotics, which usually we give them at high doses and for prolonged periods of time.
Right. Thank you for that. And definitely, you know, in the microbiology community, biofilms, you know, definitely very, very interesting to read about, not good for the patients because of the resistance that you can have for treatment and things like that. But, you know, it's kind of fascinating from the science point of view. So, right, so when we're talking about bone and joint infections and prosthetic devices, so I just, you know, I'm curious about us what the typical demographic for this type of infections are. I mean,
so it definitely depends on the type of infection. Of course, if we are talking about diabetic foot infections, we're facing patients with diabetes and usually with a bad control of their diabetes, so poorly managed the diabetes. And probably right now, currently in our hospitals, when we have a patient with a bone and joint infection, we're having a patient who is old, and we have seen that in the last years, the mean age of these patients has significantly increased over time. Actually, some years ago, we presented some data in NECMID Congress showing that the median age of patients with prosthetic joint infection in my country, in Spain, had significantly increased, and the majority of these patients were concentrated in those age 60 and older. And because of this, usually patients have comorbidities. It is frequent that our patients have, of course, diabetes, but also heart conditions, liver conditions, chronic kidney disease, and some are even under immunosuppressive treatment or under immunosuppressive condition, such as transplants, cancer, or rheumatic diseases. Some of these patients have, for example, rheumatoid arthritis and are under treatment for these rheumatic diseases, and these make them more complicated to manage. Because of these comorbidities, the old age, these patients are usually receiving a lot of drugs for their conditions, and polypharmacy is a frequent condition or characteristic of these individuals. And mainly the patients that we would see would be an old patient with comorbidities, with many chronic medications, such antidepressants or oral anticoagulants, and often with implants. No? The number of implants has significantly increased in the majority of countries because we're putting more implants for these patients because they need them, but because of this, we're seeing more and more infections over time.
Okay.
And as you said, so these infections are difficult to treat, and it is sometimes common that these patients need prolonged hospitalizations. Their infection may persist over time despite good management from the surgical and the medical team. And this is really challenging for the physicians, but also very nice from my point of view.
Well, thank you for that. So one thing, so when it comes to these infections, I'm just curious about typically what organisms do you see? And then that brings also, right, the presence of the organism. And as we know, microbiologists know, we definitely have a lot of organisms that can be, they are multi-drug resistant. So I want to ask about that, you know, what organisms are typically seen and do you get, an abundance or a presence of MDROs, multi-drug resistant organisms?
Yeah. So thanks for the question. Again, the microbiology causing these infections is very wide and variable, and it depends on the type of the infections. It's not the same having a patient with a native septic arthritis and a patient with a fracture-related infections, or as you said, a patient with a diabetic foot infection, where polymicrobial infections are really frequent. No? The physiopathology also influences a lot. It's not the same if we are facing an acute infection or even an hematogenous infection that coexists with bacteremia, or a chronic infection in which a patient may have low virulent microorganisms. So in general, gram-positive bacteria are the vast majority of the organisms causing these infections. And they may represent, depending on the type of infection, between 40, 50% to 75, 80% of all bacteria causing these infections. Gram-negative bacilli and bacteria may cause between 25 to 40%, depending on the type of infection. For example, when we talk about implant-associated infections, and particularly infections affecting spine instrumentation, if they affect the lumbar segments, gram-negative bacteria may predominate to other sort of gram-positives. No? When we talk about gram-positive, for example, we are referring to Staphylococcus aureus, coagulase negative staphylococci, streptococci, enterococci. Cutibacterium acnes is also a very important microorganism causing this infection, especially in those infections affecting shoulder arthroplasties or spine instrumentation in the cervical or the dorsal segments. And when we refer to gram-negative, we're talking about enterobacteriales, as you said, so E. coli, Klebsiella pneumoniae, enterobacter species as well, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, and this may cause around 30% to 50%, as I said, depending on the microorganisms, on the type of infection. So, and the last question was about the MDR, right? So regarding MDR microorganisms, we have seen in most countries, at least in Spain and in past parts of Europe, an increase in the numbers of these MDR microorganisms. MRSA is relatively frequent in Spain. It was a big problem some years ago. Maybe in the last years or 5-10 years, the prevalence has been reduced a little bit, but it's still a frequently encountered bacteria in our patients. And then the MDR GMB also have significantly increased over time, especially ESBL producing enterobacteriales or MDR, XDR, Pseudomonas aeruginosa. They're still, and fortunately, they're still a low percentage of all cases, but we are frequently encountering this bacteria causing these infections, especially in those patients who have been admitted to hospitals really frequently or who have been managed with different surgical procedures with failures, superinfections, and processes like that. And finally, I would say a couple of words about fungi. So they are not very frequent, very difficult to treat and to manage, usually causing a lot of relapses and failures in the management of these infections, and may cause between 0 to 5% of all cases, but in a very particular subset of patients.
You know, one thing, as I was listening to you talk about the organisms, and I definitely agree with the fact that we see, even here in the States, you know, we see the increase. And as I tell the audience, you know, I've been doing this, I guess, long enough, where I used to work before the days of MALDI-TOF, and now we have things like gene sequencing. So we were doing a little bit of the more of the old school test. But when it comes to the organisms, I remember before, maybe every now and then you will see like one KPC, and then that was it. And then most of the organisms were fairly susceptible. And now, you know, we see a lot. It's like so many, you know, we see KPCs, you know, we see NDMs, and then talk about, you know, we see CRAB or carbapenem-resistant Acinetobacter baumannii. So we definitely see an increase over the years. That's definitely, you know, I completely agree with that. Yes.
Yeah. And for example, Luis, I would say the frequency of ciprofloxacin or afuroquinolone resistance, especially among GMBs, is really concerning and worrisome. Because they are, I guess that we will talk about it later, but they are the first line of management for most infections caused by GMB. So we are seeing that more frequently in our patients, and this is something that is really worrying and may cause a lot of difficulty or add complexity in the management of these infections.
Yes, completely agree. You know, as someone that performs the testing, and when we get a profile like that, it's just, you know, it's scary, and we kind of feel for the patients, like what are they going to do? It's like, you know, we see like the complete profile, and we see resistant, and then we try, you know, some of the last line drugs, and then sometimes, you know, those come resistant as well. I'm like, my goodness, you know, like it's really shocking to see and worrisome, because you think, you know, what are they going to treat this patient with? Are they going to be okay? So when you definitely mentioned some factors, right? So of course, depending on the organism, that's going to influence, you know, the treatment that you're choosing, and of course, you know, the patient, other conditions that the patient has. So can you talk about factors that influence the selection of treatment?
Yeah, so I think there, when we have a patient in our ward with a bone and joint infection, I think when we have to select an antimicrobial treatment, I think we need to consider several factors that may be interrelated between them. So, of course, the patient. This is a factor, of course, that is one of the most important. Their age, their comorbidities, if they have kidney impairment, if they have liver impairment, the polypharmacy, which may cause interactions between some of antibiotics that we may prescribe, for example, linezolid with antidepressants, or allergies that the patient may have, beta-lactam allergies. That's something that we need to really consider when we see a patient with these infections. Another factor would be the type of antibiotic that we are looking for. So in generally, we want antibiotics that are safe and easy to give by oral route, with a good antibiofilm effect and a good PK/PD and profile, and also that can penetrate easily into bone and joints. So this is something that is difficult, because there may be some variability in penetration when it comes to most antibiotics and according to the literature. But generally, it would be higher for quinolones, rifampin, or other antibiotics such as linezolid. But also, there may be some heterogeneity between studies also. And so this is an issue that still needs more research in order to really define what are the best options for these infections in terms of antibiotic penetration. Another factor would be the type of microbiology and the resistance profile, as we mentioned before. And there is an important issue in terms of susceptibility. So would you generally select antibiotics which are susceptible according to the typical susceptibility testing, as you may know better than me. But of course, here we're talking about a biofilm infection, and we may need other parameters such as the minimum biofilm inhibitory concentration or the minimum biofilm eradication concentration, parameters that are under discussion, but because they are not easily performed in common laboratories and are parameters that are usually restricted to research, and we don't really know the correlation between these parameters and in vitro to the in vivo, or what is happening in vivo in the infection. And finally, I think we would consider the type of infection, no? So whether the infection is acute or chronic, whether it's associated with implants or not, this is very important in terms of the selection of the antibiotic and the global management. And as I said, the coexistence of bacteremia or endocarditis. Some of these infections, especially native septic arthritis or vertebral similitis, may coexist with endocarditis or endovascular infections. And this is something that will modulate our choice of the antimicrobial treatment. And One important factor is that we will need to manage these infections with a surgical procedure generally, maybe not for vertebral spondylitis, which is not performed systematically, but probably we will do it for native septic arthritis, where we will need a debridement. We would need it for a chronic spondylitis, where we may need resection or other procedures, and also for implant-associated infections, where we may need the removal of the implant or retention of the implant, depending on the characteristics of the infection. This is very important. The surgical procedure will definitely influence the antibiotic activity of the drug that we will choose. And of course, this is very important in terms of the global management of the patient, because we need a close collaboration between the surgical team and the medical team. We as medical physicians or infectious diseases specialists and or clinical microbiologists, we need to know what the surgeon has performed in the operation theater, how was the local findings, procedure was performed, if local antibiotics were used for the management of these infections. All these characteristics and particularities will, of course, influence the selection of the antibiotic and the type of the antibiotic that we will use.
And I know that you were, you know, when I listened to your talk, you also talk about maybe, you mentioned that sometimes, you know, like testing for susceptibility in biofilms, you know, there's not a lot of information, and maybe labs don't really, you know, do it. So it can be challenging. But as far as are there antibiotics that typically work well when there are biofilms?
So generally, when we are looking for an antibiofilm antimicrobial regimen, we may consider rifampin, mainly for gram-positive bacteria, and fluoroquinolones for gram-negative bacteria. We generally use them or select them for implant-associated infections, especially when we retain the hardware. So if the implant is kept in place and we are only doing a debridement and implant retention, which we often call DARE, we may prefer to use these antibiofilm antibiotics, but we also may use them in other particular situations, such as vertebral spondylitis or chronic spondylitis. So, as I said, rifampin and fluoroquinolone, rifampin, more evidence, especially against staphylococci, less against streptococci or cutibacterium, but there are some studies that suggest that they may be useful in particular situations. As you know, rifampin should be used always in combination with another antibiotic in order to prevent the emergence of resistance, especially in situations where the bacterial load may be high. And this partner antibiotic is also very important. Generally, we combine them with fluoroquinolones. But rifampin also has some problems. It may have interactions with other antibiotics, such as anticoagulants, oral contraceptives, or other drugs. And also the tolerance sometimes is bad, because some patients may present with gastrointestinal side effects or alterations in their liver tests. So this is something that we should take into consideration. And then fluoroquinolones are the first line, as I said, for infections by gram-negative bacilli, and they are thought to have good penetration against bones and good activity against biofilms.
Excellent. And there are some, from what I understood from your talking, like you talk about some when you're doing treatment, like there are some phases. Can you maybe talk more about that?
Yeah. So this is generally aimed at implant-associated infections when we manage with implant retention. So implant, as I said, implant-associated infections can be managed by retention of the hardware or removal of the implant. And of course, removal of the implant will facilitate a lot the cure of the infection, because we are removing the biofilm, we are debriding and all the tissue, And then we may use local antibiotics, which will be very useful in order to achieve good concentrations in the local site of the infection. So the really challenging scenario here are the cases that we're managing with implant retention. Generally, we are targeting or using implant retention in those patients with acute infections, with a short duration of symptoms, with a good condition of the soft tissues, and also when the implant is fixed, because it doesn't make many sense to keep that implant if the implant is loosened. So this is very important in terms of the antimicrobial treatment, because in the clinical management, although the evidence is not very abundant, I would say, well, there's not many evidence to suggest it, but this is common practice in most hospitals. We divide the treatment or the antimicrobial treatment into two phases for these cases managed by implant retention. A first phase where we prioritize antibiotics with good bactericidal activity because we have performed the surgical procedure and there may be a high bacterial load and, of course, a risk of emergence of resistance. And so we prefer antibiotics with good bactericidal activity, such as beta-lactams, vancomycin, daptomycin, and, of course, combinations. And in that phase, which lasts for 7 or 10 days after surgery, we do not use rifampin or fluoroquinolones. We keep them for a second phase when the wound is dry and all the drains have been removed. We can introduce these good antibiotics with good antibiofilm activity, such as rifampin and fluoroquinolones, which may have better activity in that particular scenario. So two phases, as I said. A first, especially for implant retention management, a first phase for 7-10 days, beta-lactams, combinations, and good bactericidal activity, antibiotics, and a second phase after these days when we have removed the drains and the skin and the wound is dry, in which we introduce rifampin, always in combination with another antibiotic, or fluoroquinolones for GMB infections.
Thank you for that. So by now, you definitely, you know, we have talked about, you have mentioned challenges, you know, when it comes to treating disinfections, you know, many factors. Is there anything else that can be a challenge when you're treating this type of infections?
So I think there are many issues that are still under debate. For example, the length of treatment. Classically, we have treated disinfections for a very prolonged periods of time. Months or even using suppressive treatments systematically. I think in the last years we have made some progress in terms of the length of the treatment by with some observational studies, but also some trials. There was a trial on bacterial osteomyelitis some years ago, which was performed in France, that showed that 6 weeks of treatment was not inferior to 12 weeks. And that was a nice achievement. And those same authors tried to reproduce that in a trial, which was published some years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, the DATIPO trial. And in that study targeting prosthetic joint infections, they wanted to compare whether 6 weeks was non-inferior to 12 weeks, and they could not prove non-inferiority. Apparently, they included all types of prosthetic joint infections managed either by implant retention or implant removal. And of course, we have said that these are very difficult, different managements in terms of the challenge that represents for the antimicrobial treatment. And the differences were especially dependent on those patients managed by implant retention. So we don't really know whether a short treatment could be useful for those patients managed with implant removal. This is something that we'll need to clarify in the future. Other challenges, so especially the management of those infections by multidrug resistant organisms, there are some groups as I know, a group in France, in Lyon, that are using phages for some of these infections with some good results, but especially in those patients that are in under suppressive treatment or that are not eligible for more surgical procedures. And this is something that will need to be addressed in the future. And then, of course, we still need to clarify surgical strategies for the particular patients, the type of bacteria causing the infection, or the type of patient. And this is something that will need to be clarified in with the future research.
Excellent. You know, this has been so great. And I always love to kind of just step a little bit outside the lab and see what happens, you know, with the patients, you know, those samples that we work with, and from the scientists, you know, nerdy point of view, you know, we see those organisms, and you know, it's fascinating seeing all the science, but it's so good to see, you know, learn about what happens to the human being and you know, at the other end of that culture. So this has been great. Now, as the episode comes to a close, is there anything else that you want to add or tell the audience?
So I would like to thank the opportunity to join you, Luis, for this session and this nice talk. I think bone and gene infections are really challenging and very interesting in terms of treatment. They are difficult to treat, but really worth the effort. And I hope your colleagues in the States and the audience that are listening to you will be joining this field of practice and research in the near future.
Excellent. Well, you know, like I said, Dr. Gomez, you know, this has been a pleasure, and definitely a pleasure, you know, having you here. And I so appreciate you taking the time to being Let's Talk Micro.
Yeah, thank you very much.
My pleasure. And that, my dear audience, it's the end of this episode. I hope you enjoyed learning about bone and joint infections. As always, I enjoy sharing this information with you. Right, definitely a lot of good content about organisms and, you know, talk about antibiotics and this type of infection. So I think, you know, I definitely learned a lot, and I hope you did as well. As always, continue bringing that passion to what you do. It's so important, right? You do such great work. And stay tuned. Thank you for the support. Great episodes coming your way. A lot of good things. So, as always, stay motivated, stay safe, and of course, continue talking micro. Until the next time. Bye.